Monster Man, episode 277, A Fire on the Velvet Horizon. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're deviating a little from our brief to look at the gaming books of yesteryear and looking at something a little more contemporary. As you know, we recently concluded Season 3 of Monster Man, and we're taking a short break between seasons. We're going to start looking at another classic monster book in Season 4, but for now, I want to take a look at a range of different books, and today we're looking at Fire on the Velvet Horizon. Fire on the Velvet Horizon was written by Patrick Stewart and illustrated by Scrap Princess. In fact, I think it sort of goes the other way around in that it begins with the illustrations and then Stewart writes monster descriptions for them. It came out, there's no date in the text, but it came out a couple of years ago, and it is a systemless monster book. So it's a series of monsters, but none of them have any mechanics associated with them, or at least not like numerical mechanics. They don't have stat blocks. Although you'll see that like in-game effects are in fact described within the monster entries. It's currently available either in the hard copy or in an art-free pay-what-you-want version. Obviously the pay-what-you-want version is more affordable. I do think you lose something not having the art. The most notable thing about the kind of visual presentation of Fire on the Velvet Horizon is that it's done in a very kind of like zine-like fashion, so sort of crude cut and paste and a mixture of typography and hand-drawn stuff, and it looks like that zine aesthetic that zine producers cultivated long after they had left behind the physical methods that made that look unavoidable. Very splotchy, very kind of jagged transitions. It's a particular and distinctive look. It has some spot color, although it's mostly in black and white. And I picked two monsters out of this book to talk about today, basically at random. In fact, I think one of them is the first one, and then another is just one that I sort of settled on, kind of scrolling down and seeing what appealed to me. And I think when you listen to me talk about these two monsters, you'll see on the one hand why I like this book, and on the other hand, why I'm not doing a whole season of it. Because if I did a season of Fire on the Velvet Horizon, you would quite quickly hear me say the same basic couple of things about a lot of these monsters. And not that they're not all interesting in their own way, but that there are some themes or artistic trends that run through them. And even, you know, an artist giving an author illustrations and then the author working from them or whatever it is, you know, ultimately, this is a relatively focused creative product. It doesn't have the grab bag quality of the big monster books. And as a result, it kind of lends itself less well to the episodic format that I've decided to pursue here on Monster Man. One of the things that I really like about books like Fire on the Velvet Horizon is game creation is, I've said before, an act of bricolage. I know I'm using that word a lot lately, but what I mean basically is that a lot of games involve the recombination of elements from other media or other games and the use of those elements in new and creative ways. Every game that I run is a product of my interests, the things that I've studied, the things that I've read and watched, the music that I like. You know, there's a character in my Other Dust game at the moment whose name is Kamachi, and he's named after a rapper. There's Cold War elements in a lot of my games because I studied it a lot. Or there's Vikings in a lot of my games, a lot of that kind of thing. You know, it's just all the things that are kind of knocking around, providing raw material inside my brain. You know, I build the things that I create out of that raw material. And one of the best ways, you know, if you feel like you're in a creative rut, is to put new raw material in there. Whether that's going to an art gallery, or, you know, reading an author you've never read before, or, you know, watching a movie you don't know anything about, or anything like that. Just as long as you're kind of not, if your input is in a rut, it's going to contribute to your output being in a rut as well. So one of the things that I think is really wonderful about reading these more personal kind of indie products is that they bear the distinctive voice of their creators. You know, they are not just another variation on the Monster Manual. They are taking that root, the Monster Manual, and turning it into something completely different. And that, in turn, is inspirational for my own work, even if I never actually use any of the things that are in this book. It exposes me to new perspectives, new images, new ideas, and that's valuable. So, let's take a look at these two monsters. First up, we have the Abhorror. Now, the Abhorror is basically, it's described as a demon here. I think in Dungeons & Dragons terms, we would call that a devil. Indeed, it's a very devilish devil. But one of the things that I like about Fire on the Velvet Horizon is Stewart's writing, so I'm going to just read you very briefly some extracts from the description of the Abhorror. Anyone approaching one can clearly see it is a slug, a huge and monstrous slug, 9 feet high, with a shark-like triangle mouth, intelligent black eyes, and rows of flaccid arms hanging from its sides. They do not like interacting with the world, except to destroy. As you approach, the urge to kill it rises in your throat like broaching spew. Your fingers twitch with the desire to do it harm, to pierce its monstrous body with the blade, to crush it with a weight, to slice its grinning face, anything at all to let it no more be, to burn the wound of it from the world. But your fingers loose from your hilt. Your fist refuses to clench. You reach out, smiling, to shake it by the hand. Nothing disordered the Abhorror can stand. It is a pool of order in the world. Nothing illegal can happen around it, nothing impolite. No one can be hurt or struck or harmed. People can be hanged or whipped or otherwise destroyed, but only if it is within the law. So it emerges that the Abhorrors are lawful evil. I mean, it doesn't say that, but what I mean is that they are creatures who are here to impose, not even to impose, but to exploit law. They are legal experts, and they delight in the evil that the law permits. So if the law permits slavery, the Abhorrors enslave people. And they don't just enslave them like to profit, they enslave them to torment them, to torture them, even to kill them, and to delight specifically in the fact of lawful suffering. They will legally buy up artistic works and then destroy them just to do evil by the mechanism of the law. So these are tremendous devils. I love them. Like, in terms of satire, well, listen to this description of how Abhorrors behave. As the Abhorrors see the world, there are only beings like them, beings who are lying about being like them, or beings too stupid to be like them. They genuinely do not comprehend that all other races and cultures do not regard each other with secret and eternal hate. They will assume that any claims to the contrary are clever lies and politely pretend to agree. They love the petty wrongs, elisions, small flaws, mild lies, and worming resentments that make up a part of daily life, treating them with complicit amusement and secret joy. If they see this behavior in you this way, they will mark their notice with some look or turn of phrase that indicates that you've been accepted into a clever clique. Now, the Abhorrors are monstrous, but they're protected by this essentially supernatural field of lawfulness that surrounds them. No illegal act is possible. So there are only two ways to defeat them. The first is revolution, riot. If you overthrow the law and reduce the land to a state of anarchy, then the Abhorror is powerless. And your window for action will be limited because out of chaos, a new social order will arise and the Abhorror will simply adapt to that. But so in the moment of true lawlessness, you can destroy the Abhorror. The other is that you can destroy the Abhorror through the path of crime. That is to say, if you can do things that are superficially legal, you can kill the Abhorror. So if you can get yourself deputized with a license to kill, or if you can bribe a judge to sentence it to death, or anything like that, you can destroy the Abhorror. You work within the forms of the law, but perverting them with corruption and intimidation and whatever. So you can frame an Abhorror, and it will just have to go along with it.
It says, they will die passively, screaming, placing their own heads upon the block, calling out that they've been framed, set up, and sent down. It's the truth.
But nobody will care. These guys are fabulous. I mean, as a piece of social satire, maybe they're a bit on the nose, but, you know, if the shoe fits, wear it. And they make the idea of lawfulness matter, and most importantly, they are a scenario where you have one of these things making a nightmare of itself. It can kind of exist as an NPC in the background. You know, they tend to live in cities because those are lawful places, so you can have one in the background of a fantasy city acting as a kind of advisor, you know, a sort of legal expert on behalf of an unjust but legal rule. And then you realize, you know, first off, someone tries to kill it, and that just completely fails because violent acts can't happen to it, and you're like, well, you discover the source of its magical protection. And then you take either one of these two paths to get at it. And the PCs love a caper, right? This is a caper. And everybody loves a caper. The next monster is something called a mermaid. Now, that's not a mermaid. It's a mermaid. And so it inhabits, you know, mirrors. Stagnant ponds, sluggish rivers. They live in still water. And a lot of the time, they just kind of hang there. Now, the mermaid is an example of another type of monster found in Fire on the Velvet Horizon, in that I think it's a very evocative image, but it doesn't necessarily imply action. It's not really something that characters have to make decisions about, whether morally or tactically. So what the mermaid does is it just kind of hangs out in its underwater burrow. It is like a mermaid in some senses. It has an eel's tail instead of a fish. You can tell, I think, that they find eels
kind of spooky and grim, which I certainly agree with. As a feature of the East Anglian landscape, I like a good eel. Also, like mermaids, they like to seduce and destroy people, but unlike mermaids, they're not very good at it, as the description says. Mermaids would love to seduce men and devour them raw, but they are not very good at it. They're lazy, dirty, distinctly alien-looking, and they smell. They make no attempt to alter or modify any of these things. Men find them frightening and strange. What the mermaids can do is sing, I don't even know that this is like a tactic they employ, this is just a thing that they do. They sing a mournful song that attracts women. And if someone is susceptible to this, what happens is that they go and they become a mermaid themselves. They go and they go into the water and they just eventually live among the mermaids. And so this is something that people are worried about, you know, could happen to their, you know, oh, my daughter has disappeared. Perhaps she has gone to go live among the mermaids. And someone might have to go and rescue her, I guess, but she might not want to be rescued. Mermaids also have a gimmick where they construct elaborate fantasy lives. They kind of just hang out underwater most of the time daydreaming, and they have these images, like counters, that they use to represent people. So they collect treasure that has faces on it. So coins obviously would be an example, but they don't like to collect a large number of the same coin because that's the same person. It's not that interesting. So coins, cameos, you know, statuettes, portraits, idols, I guess, you know, and icons, all of those things would be appealing to the mermaid because they could basically become characters within the mermaid's fantasy. And so that could be where a particularly valuable item has gone, right? Is that a mermaid has taken it down to their underwater lair to put it into their fantasy life, and if you take it away, they will get very upset. So the treasure thing is nice, and I like the idea of what they're doing with the treasure, you know, that they're doing something quite simultaneously alien, but also sort of relatable. I mean, they remind me of gamers, obviously, but they also kind of remind me of childhood fantasy worlds, you know, like the Brontes or C.S. Lewis with Boxen, right, where like different stuffed animals became characters in this increasingly elaborate fantasy. And I like the mermaids a lot. I do think that they are more of an evocative image than they are a compelling adventure hook. And this makes me feel sometimes like Fire on the Velvet Horizon is an artwork in ludic form, maybe more than it is a thing that you would use in an actual game. Now, for my purposes, I think I got it on the cheap in a bundle of holding or something like that. I don't think I shelled out full price for it, or I got it on a sale or something. I mean, I don't remember, but I certainly didn't pay $40 for the hard copy, but I also do have the PDF of the version with the illustrations, so I don't know where that came from. But for my purposes, where I'm just kind of looking for inspiration that will ultimately make its way into my games in a different form, then that's perfect. So I think that this sort of thing definitely has a role to play, and I'm not criticizing it for not being a conventional monster book, but it's not. And that's why I don't necessarily feel like I can devote a whole season to it, because I'm going to say the same thing about a lot of these entries, which is that they're interesting to ruminate on and incorporate into your own games, or use as influences. Maybe not even use as, but just kind of let add to the pool of influences that create the stuff that you put in your own games. But I don't know that it is directly useful at your table. It's just a lot of fun to read. Okay, that is about all the monsters that we have time for today. In our next episode, who knows? I'm making this up as I go along. Oh, well, I take that back. Our next episode is a special episode, and that's going to be about golems. Not conventional golems like the one we've covered, but other golems. Then after that, it's anybody's guess. Keep those suggestions coming, everyone. I'm really enjoying reading them. And I will see you next time on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.